This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about exercise as a factor in mental health. So to start off with, I've got some key facts. The first is from the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. Researchers found that those who got regular vigorous activity were 25% less likely to develop depression or an anxiety disorder over the next 5 years. So this stat I found particularly useful as a clear example of just how direct this link between exercise and mental health is. It's something that's broadly acknowledged, but there's kind of at times fluctuating levels of actual research into it.
Yeah.
And a lot of different claims thrown around. Of course, we'd never be on this show suggesting that exercise is a cure to any mental illness, but it can be a really important factor in mental health recovery or just saving off getting the mental illness in the first place as part of a general healthy lifestyle. Anything you wanted to add to that one first off?
Yeah, I read an interview somewhere once. I can't remember the citation, but I remember an interview once somewhere with a doctor who said if they could prescribe exercise as a pill, so people didn't have to do exercise, they could literally just ingest the effects of exercise, it would be the most prescribed pill, I think, ever. I can't remember precisely what they said, but the implication that of the effects that it would have were really astounding. And I was like, that sounds amazing. I wish I could take a pill that was exercise, considering I have a chronic fatigue condition. I really struggle to exercise myself. And I think that I'm going through a process of getting some more support for my exercise because it's something I do need some more support with. But I just found it so astounding that that would be the one thing that doctors would go for if they could like sort of put something in a pill or in a pill form. But they're like, no, but just unfortunately you just have to get out and do it. But then obviously that presents lots of problems for people with limited capabilities to exercise as well. So that can be really, really frustrating.
Right, absolutely. But it's a good point that you raised there that it can have benefits far beyond any one condition. In fact, exercise is so vital to a healthy lifestyle in general. And so I can see why, if it did come in a pill form, that would be something relevantly prescribable to most of what people go to the doctors for.
Sure.
Which is quite cool. Sadly, that's not the case. But I do have more information on how actual exercise can be useful. The NHS also carried out their own research into this and confirmed physical activity causes chemical changes in the brain, which help us to positively change our mood. And also, they looked into the financial side as well and found the cost to the NHS of physical inactivity in England is conservatively estimated at £900,000. So a massive amount, because of course it's public knowledge that the NHS needs a lot more funding. And so it is interesting how many situations are exacerbated by poor lifestyle. And that's not me trying to blame the public for NHS underfunding, not at all. But it is staggering when you look at some of the statistics, how much of the demand on the NHS is potentially preventable. And at no time do you see that more, I think, than of a weekend in A&E when there's so many alcohol or drug-related injuries. So it is interesting to consider. And another thing they found on the financial side is aggregating non-healthcare costs, such as low productivity, gives an estimated total cost of $8.2 billion per annum.
Wow.
Again, attributable to physical inactivity. So that's taking into account not just the NHS, but the kind of economic costs in general. And that was really fascinating. So to link in with that, Mind also found a whole host of other positive effects of exercise. They highlighted better sleep, improved self-esteem, and increased ability to connect with other people. So I thought that was, again, a great example of how broad the benefits of exercise can be. So we'll get into the episode soon with our wonderful repeat guest. Suki Bassi. She previously did an episode with us all about burnout. So similarly to this, she's really got two quite key factors where they have a really broad reach in terms of mental health, but also just well-being in general. I'm really delighted to have her back. She's so delightful and was so well received the first time. Was there anything else you wanted to add on this topic, Annie?
I'm just so excited to hear from Suki again. Her last episode was so great and I just really can't wait to hear more of her insight.
Yeah, she's so lovely. Of course, you don't have to listen to any of our episodes chronologically, but if you enjoy this one, I definitely recommend taking a look at her burnout episode a few weeks back. So that's everything for now. We'll get into the episode with Suki in a moment, but first... Who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Suki Bassi. I'm a big fan of physical activity. I've struggled, for want of a better word, with depression pretty much most of my adult life. And one of the most kind and helpful things I've ever been able to do when I have been able to, and I know that with my depression that I haven't always been able to do, is to move. And I say move as opposed to exercise or run or classes, because sometimes it's literally a snail's pace of movement to help me just process what I'm going through.
So for you, exercise was a big part of your life for a long time anyway. And so when did that kind of start and when did it change into you realising the link to mental health?
I think exercise has been an important part of my life from sort of probably my early 30s. It hadn't been up till that point. I was asthmatic at school. So what they did in those days was just excuse you from exercise. They just excused you from PE. And I think I got into exercise more in my late 20s and early 30s, but from a very aesthetic point of view, if I needed to drop a couple of pounds or if I felt like I needed to look better. I think it took until my late 30s for me to start seeing some positive links with movement, with exercise and my mental health. And so it was more finding out by accident that it was a far healthier way for me to process things than the other coping mechanisms that I had.
Right. And so what led to you finding that out?
I was really lucky to be involved with a groundbreaking project at the time, which was a partnership between the YMCA and the NHS to launch something which unfortunately no longer exists, which I think is a real shame, called the Healthy Living Centres, where it was taking a far more proactive approach to activity and health within communities. So if you think about it, most of us will go and see our GP or even our pharmacist when something has gone wrong, right? When we're not necessarily at crisis, but when something has manifested itself. We don't go from a perspective of preventative care. Mm-hmm. We go when something has gone wrong. And when we look at things like gyms or community centres or fitness centres, we go because we're working, in most cases, on some sort of, you know, physical aesthetic of what we think fitness looks like. This partnership was groundbreaking because it was actually trying to partner up all of our different community provisions. So be that a gym, be that a community centre, be that the local pharmacist, be that the local GP, and join them up. So whether we are talking about patients that looked like they were, you know, borderline to be diagnosed with diabetes, or we were looking at patients who were recovering from, say, you know, heart surgery, and working with community organisations to say, let's put the community at the heart of this. Let's open up spaces where people feel safe to not just exercise, but to talk about their experiences. So I was actually on the steering group of, you know, I was representing the YMCA on the steering group of all of these different community partners. And we were very successful in getting the, you know, the lottery funding at that time to get this off the ground. And I think it was working not just on the bid, but working with all of these key partners that opened my eyes up to the fact that exercise is, well, I use the word exercise advisedly, that physical activity should not be a bolt-on to our lives. Our whole evolution was dependent upon our mobility and how we have evolved our, you know, our physical anatomy. So it shouldn't be a bolt-on. It should be a fundamental part of our lives. And then once the community gym actually opened and it was on the exact same site as my office, I suddenly had a facility that I could use at any time of the day or night, that I could pop in for conversations with the community users. We worked with refugees and asylum seekers using the gym. We were looking at preventative patients who'd been referred because, you know, for preventative measures. And we were also dealing with patients who were, you know, post-surgery or post some sort of intervention. And we were also using just users from the local population. Mm-hmm. And so it just opened up this world for me to see physical activity and exercise as something for everyone, that it wasn't just for people on the cover of a glossy magazine. It was fundamental for our physical well-being, but also for our mental and emotional well-being when we connect with other people. So some of the refugees and asylum seekers we worked with had been victims of torture. So we worked with Médecins Sans Frontières and another couple of sort of refugee organisations. And some of the refugees opening up about the fact that they felt that this was a safe space, physically and emotionally. So whether it was physical scars that they were conscious of or it was emotional scars, that couple of years just reframed my whole thinking about what exercise and physical activity is and what it means.
Right, and it sounds like you were able to create such a powerful, inclusive space to bring these people together. So actually, they came into this environment for the physical benefits, but then once there, they realised, oh, it's a safe space for me to open up about what I've been through or to meet other people who have had similar experiences. And from there, it seems like the mental health side came through, because, of course, it is a massive factor, exercise in and of itself in mental health, but also when you're able to build that community element into it, it just increases so much more.
Absolutely. And I wish I could take credit, but I really can't. The actual steering group was already in flight when I joined the YMCA. But like you've said, the reach of the programme was phenomenal. And the fact that it makes you realise, it made me realise, the sort of stereotypes that we have about people, that I would decide if somebody was a gym person or not, and that would be broken down. I remember being on a treadmill once, and I was really into my running at the time. Well, I still am, but on a treadmill once, and this gentleman, you know, probably in his 60s, early 70s, quite overweight, he was struggling to breathe and walk, and came over and started giving me pointers on my gait and how my foot lands. I pronate a little bit. And, you know, my first sort of assumption was, who does he think he is? What's he talking about? I've got a personal trainer, which I did at the time. And yet when I came off, I think my sort of my natural curiosity and my natural empathy was, let's have this conversation. And this was a gentleman who'd run marathons all around the world, who'd, you know, talking about his experiences of running in New York or running in Brazil. And that bit of my assumptions coming crashing down, of just going, what you think is fit or what you think is healthy or what you think somebody is, isn't necessarily, you know, accurate. So, yes, yeah, some of it was a steep learning curve and a very valuable one.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you've highlighted there is that really the biggest factor is the effort that you put in, because me being thin that I am, I by default have a certain advantage over someone who's overweight when it comes to, let's say, going on a running machine. But that's neither here nor there. If I never go to the gym, what difference does that make? Someone can still be healthier than me because they're actually putting the time in, irrespective of what we look like on the outside.
Absolutely. And I think that it was this space. I can't imagine that sort of conversation happening in a conventional gym facility. I can't imagine that sort of conversation happening in...
Well, there wouldn't otherwise be a reason that you two would cross paths and have a conversation and learn your similarities. But actually, there's something great and unifying about exercise in that it's hard work for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see that guy at the gym that's massive and clearly hits the weights week in, week out, but he's still pushing himself, his own body. And so you've got that in common, that no matter where you are in your journey for physical health, much like with mental health, there's so much that unites us far more than divides us.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think where you see this evidence now is parkrun. I do parkrun religiously every single Saturday. And I just love the sense of community. It doesn't matter whether you're 4 or 94. It doesn't matter whether you can do it in 18, 20 minutes or you can do it in an hour, 18 minutes. It is for everybody. And it's, in a way, it feels like the physical benefits are, you know, a side effect, as in it's that sense of community, it is that sense of belonging, it is a sense of support that people give each other that just trumps anything else.
Right. And so with you being in this environment and learning so much more about how fundamental exercise can be in our well-being as a whole, where was your mental health at?
At that point, I think I put on a very good veneer in my life. On the outside, everything was picture perfect. Professional life, picture perfect. Social life, picture perfect. What the demons I was probably battling below the surface were a whole different matter. And I think that that environment gave me, in some respects, a much healthier outlet for some of my demons. So having, I mean, it was the first time in my life I'd ever worked somewhere where I had a gym on site. So the fact that I could either drop in for a coffee or go and use the treadmill for half an hour in the middle of the day and nobody would bat an eyelid became a far healthier way of me managing my stress or even unpacking issues. You know, sometimes when you've just got some complex work stuff that you're trying to work through, and the harder you look at it, the longer you look at it, the more spreadsheets you open, it's just more confusing. And one of the healthiest things that you can do, and few people do it, is to step up, you know, to get up, step away from it, and go do something totally different for 30, 40 minutes. That's what the Healthy Living Centre gave to me. So whether that was popping on the treadmill or going and having a coffee with somebody that I hadn't chatted to before, or, you know, it was the first time I'd ever done weights, it was, you know, or go do a weights class, it just activated different parts of my brain that more creative, perhaps. And I don't want to use the word productive because that's quite loaded, but it sort of helped me to think a bit more laterally. And it also meant, I remember having a really major board meeting that I had to prepare for, and I was presenting papers on all the projects that I was running, so it was, you know, pretty grim. And then to compound the stress of the board meeting, I'd gone on pretty much an all-night drinking binge the night before. Yeah, it was bad. So in the morning, having this, you know, absolutely god-awful headache, preparing for this board meeting, and I don't know what made me, and it was just like, do you know what, I'm just going to go and work it out on the treadmill for 30 minutes rather than, you know, mainline coffee. And I think that coming off that treadmill after 30 minutes and just going, I got this, I have absolutely got this, as opposed to just working myself into, you know, into more stress or more anxiety. And I'm not saying it was a panacea by, you know, any stretch of any imagination, but it just gave me a different way of looking at things, right, and framed it in a much more positive way.
Mm. And that's sometimes all you need. For me, just going for a walk makes so much difference, because it gets you away from the screen. I do a lot of my best thinking when I'm walking, and then you come back to it with fresh eyes.
Absolutely.
It makes such a difference. One thing the listeners won't know is that before most of our recording sessions, I go for a coffee or lunch, often just on my own, just to actually like get out of the space, have a bit of a refresh, some fresh air. And then I'm sort of coming into the podcasting environment intentionally. I've not just been sitting around waiting. I'm coming especially with a refreshed brain, refreshed body from a bit of a move around. And so then I'm ready to sit for the 3-4 hours it can take to get through.
I really like that, Bobby. I'm also a qualified coach. And when I do coaching sessions, my palate cleanser, for want of a better term, is to take a walk. It just, that bit of your... If your eyes, your brain taking in other information, processing things differently, and then you come back for the next session and you're ready. You're not carrying baggage from the previous session or for what you're having for your tea or whatever, and you're fresh.
Right. And it sounds like the environment you were in at that time really helped with how you frame activity, because that was so at the heart of the project. In our kind of hyper digital worlds, where so often we are doing our most productive work in front of a computer, we can see being out and about as a hindrance to that. And it's really lovely that you were in an environment where exercise was held so high that you never needed to feel that guilt of going and spending half hour on the treadmill and just taking those times out.
Yeah. And it was an environment where, whether it was exercise or community, it was respected. So if I'd just taken half an hour to have a coffee with one of the residents, exactly the same. That it was, nobody was going, well, where's Suki? You know, and I think, let's be honest, in most working environments, you could not disappear for half an hour without a scheduled meeting or a scheduled reason. And so one of the things I'm very passionate about for any of us who work in sort of office environments, and or especially if you work from home, is that you schedule breaks. That you schedule breaks where you step away from your desk. That you do something that involves movement, that you do something that is cognitively different.
Right. It's incredible how we can do that as well. We put breaks on other people, that I take a break because my boss tells me to, or because it's on the timetable. The break's actually for you.
Yeah.
And that applies almost more so when you're self-employed, because you are running the ship, whether you've got a team or not. And so you're actually the most important person to take a break.
Absolutely. And I think that when you're the boss, you will put yourself at the bottom of that pecking order. And I would argue, no, you need to put yourself at the top, because if you're okay, you will make sure your team are okay. But secondly, because you need to be modelling that behaviour. There is no point writing policies that say, we discourage you having your lunch at your desk, or we discourage this, or we discourage that, when the actual lived reality is the absolute opposite of that. So I think that as being self-employed, as a business owner, you've got to prioritise taking a break, taking a walk, having some fresh air. First and foremost, because if you're not okay, your team won't be okay. But secondly, and just as importantly, you need to be modelling that behaviour. So I find that in a lot of workplaces, they'll have all these brilliant policies of don't take lunch at your desk, make sure you take a minimum of 30 minutes, but not one of the senior management do that. So very soon, new starters learn that the culture is you have lunch at your desk, or you don't take a lunch break. So I think that the more we can model that behaviour ourselves, the better, you know, it's better practice.
Right, absolutely. And that should be a fundamental part of management, but so often it isn't, that you need to enforce looking after the team and them looking out for themselves just as much as you need to enforce the rules and the things they can't do.
Absolutely. And this is where I think that walking the talk is so important. When we do a lot of sort of mental health work or well-being work in workplaces, people, again, think it's an add-on. They think, well, we give you free fresh fruit.
Mm.
Isn't that sufficient? Well, is it sufficient depending upon the rest of the environment? And if the environment is that people are at their desks from 8 a.m, they eat lunch at their desks, they're discouraged from leaving the building, they don't leave until 6, what sort of working environment, creatively, let alone productively, let alone humanly, are we creating?
Right, and it goes back to that proactive approach you talked about at the start of the interview, that we need to be integrating this kind of preemptive support through, whether it's the NHS or whether it's the workplace, whatever the environment is so important to our well-being. Because, like you mentioned there, having fruit in the office, great idea by all means, but it shouldn't be a band-aid. You should be proactively trying to support people, not just thinking, okay, how many additional pro things can we stick on to make up for the areas we're lacking?
That's exactly true. And in my experience, in a lot of workplaces, they will have policies for when things hit crisis. So if you go off sick, HR will know exactly what to do. If you have a mental health crisis, HR will signpost you to the employee assistance program.
Right.
But there is nothing in place to prevent you reaching crisis. There is nothing that is saying, how do we create supportive and healthy working environments and workplace cultures? That we kind of only know what to do when we're ready to triage something. Mm. What we don't say is, what could we be doing better? And one of the simplest things from a physical activity point of view is for people to take a 30-minute break, to physically leave their desk, you know, to walk out of the office, to have a change of scenery. One of the things I always suggest to clients, which is absolutely free, is to plot a local 30-minute walk. Most places will be within a catchment area of some green space. It might not be the loveliest green space, but it will be nicer than your keyboard and your screen. And to actively encourage people to take right. that walk. I don't smoke, but I take what I ostensibly call cigarette breaks, where literally if something's getting a bit confused or a bit too much for me, I get up and I walk around the block. Guilt-free, I'd have no problem feeling, you know, stepping outside for a cigarette. Why would I feel guilty for stepping away from my desk to go pound, you know, the block? And it just right. helps clear your mind.
And as a side point to add on to that, what a lot of people don't realise is that local councils take into account usage of green spaces when deciding whether to keep them.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so it can be the smallest thing, but if you don't use those spaces, you'll lose them because they'll assume that people don't need it, but we all need green space. It's part
Thank you, Bobby. I'm going to add that to my business case then. I did not know that.
Yeah, no, they'll have people will go and monitor and literally tally up how many people are using a space when trying to make a proposal to turn it into more flats or whatever.
Wow. So use it or lose it.
Essentially, yeah. That's the model, and that's a big part of why we do lose so many green spaces, because it's a part of a larger societal problem that they're not prioritised,
wow.
that nature is not prioritised. Instead, we have more workspaces, which is something we seem to have plenty of as it is. And one thing I wanted to just kind of loop back on while I remember is, obviously, you've built all this insight looking back on it. But something I remember from our previous interview was that you were really good at looking after other people before you were good at looking after yourself. So was there a turning point for you personally when you realised the power of exercise in your own mental health and just benefiting your life in general?
I think my turning point, Bobby, would have been when I had my full-on breakdown. And at that point, I think I was even using exercise negatively, as in everything was over the top. I was working too hard.
Actually, I had that feeling. Yeah.
I was exercising too hard. And it's one of the things that I now, you know, talk about when we're looking at what the triggers of even, you know, what the symptoms of burnout. And that is when you are overdoing everything. And I think recovering from my breakdown made me be more gentle with absolutely everything I did, because even when I was up to even going out for a walk again, it was like my limbs were exceptionally heavy. I don't think I could have walked any faster if I'd tried. I remember once being in the park and being very aware of my body and just how slowly I was walking. And I think that that's what movement and activity gives you, because at the end of the day, your spectrum is only your spectrum. You shouldn't be competing against anybody else. And if you have mobility issues or anything else, you should know what your baseline is. But it took the walk, because I wouldn't have recognised that on the couch. I wouldn't have recognised that in bed. It took the movement of being mindful of how my body even felt and how it needed me to be gentle. So I think the turning point of the breakdown had a double effect of not just knowing sort of who I was psychologically, but being much kinder to myself physiologically as well.
Yes, because that's something we've touched on talking about previously, this work hard, play hard mentality. Yeah. And it's very easy to fall into this trap of going into exercise for the right reasons, and of course plenty of people go into them for the wrong reasons as well, but then even with good intentions you can then start workifying your leisure time. Yeah. And so then it takes that fun out of it, it takes the joy and the productivity out of it when you're over analyzing your own workout and making it into something that's just as draining as
Absolutely.
Being at work.
So whether you're pulling too much data and making it draining, or you are pushing yourself too much. So you are exercise, you are, you know, creating even more work for your adrenal glands. They're already exhausted and you're going, but no, I have to do, you know, a military fitness class, or I have to do boot camp, or I do, it's all of these even hard workouts where if you're already depleted, they are perhaps not the most productive workouts at that time. They are great at other times, but it's also recognising balance, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And so coming out of your breakdown then, to what degree was exercise a factor in recovery?
It was a huge factor, because I think I'd recalibrated even what my sense of expectations or achievement were, and being able to move became a key measure, I suppose. I would go to the Arboretum in Walsall and I would walk around the lake, and it became, did I walk around the lake once? And then slowly building up to I walked around the lake twice. And so I think that movement, and I'm very conscious of using the word exercise, because it becomes loaded in a different sense. Movement gave me a way of being kind to myself, a way of being mindful, a way of just getting oxygen into my lungs. So it became something key that I could actually measure, that, you know, a month ago I was only walking around the lake once a week, to, oh, now I'm walking around the lake, you know, twice a week. Mm. That it became something where I could actually feel that I was improving, even though lots of other things in my life felt very, very stagnant. The movement of being in the park, or speaking to the groundskeeper, or saying hello to somebody walking their dog, became again a measure of even interaction, because I wasn't doing that otherwise. So it was a huge building block.
Right, and there's a important distinction even in what you've said there between going further and going harder, that it's not always about how much can I sweat, how many reps can I do in how little time. Sometimes, particularly when you're at your worst with your mental health, it's about, can I walk as far as the further corner shop?
Absolutely. And it turned my whole sense of expectation on its head. And that was quite tough. And I think, in a way, that with the breakdown, it left me with no other choice. I couldn't have, there wasn't anything left in me to force myself to do anymore. That if I, you know, if I'd made it to the park, if I'd left my, you know, if I'd left my room, let alone left the house, and I'd made it to the park, I was like, that's a win. So even just how you measured a win changed. And I think, I mean, that was a decade ago. And I think I've really just built up from that. And I've never forgotten what that gentleness and that kindness actually feels like. So even though now I may be much more physically active, I may run regularly, I may exercise regularly, I think I use it far more as a barometer now to check in with myself as opposed to as a means to an end.
Right. That's really wonderful. It's such, so lovely to hear the journey you've gone through and how you've not only just learned the skill set and the importance of an active lifestyle, but as time's gone on, you've found more and more applications in your life and really integrated it into your day to day. And that's something that is such a privilege and something you're so lucky to have. But one thing I wanted to ask you about just before we wrap up is that that's not something that I think a lot of women from a South Asian background are equipped with. There's not a huge amount of seemingly like proactive encouragement as there is boys or girls in from other backgrounds. What do you think about that?
I think that's a very, very valid point. I do hope that from the generational point of view, that is changing, that you see as many young women participating in physical activity as you see young men. But you're absolutely right for the older generation. My mom actually set up a women's group for South Asian women. She set it up about 20 years ago for that very reason. She wanted to create a safe space for women to come to do walking, to do yoga, to do laughter therapy. Did you know that that was a thing?
I have heard
of
that.
And
it's hilarious to watch if anyone wants to Google that.
And for that very reason, that she was conscious that a lot of the health issues that her friends were complaining about were easily remedied by just being more physically active. Again, like I say, it's certainly not a panacea for everything, but the sense of community that it gave them and the safety in numbers. So if suddenly they were power walking around the park, it's a bit difficult to try and shame 30 or 40 Asian women than it is to shame one or two. But I do think things are changing. The local park run that I do, there are three amazing women who do it in full hijab. Full hijab, and they kick my PB every single week.
Personal best, if someone doesn't.
Yeah. So I do hope that with role models like that, that, you know, the world is changing.
Yeah. And that's really lovely to hear. And it's no doubt going to create a ripple effect because something like seeing hijabi women running is still very rare, but it's something that it may just take you seeing once to realise, oh, if it's okay for them, it's okay for me.
Yeah.
And that can make such a difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So we'll wrap up on that nice positive note. And so is there anything else you wanted to kind of mention or promote about your work now before we finish?
No, I mean, thank you for having me, Bobby. If anybody would like to know more about the workplace interventions that Happy Maven do, please check out our website, which is happymaven.co.uk. We're also on Twitter and Instagram, and we're launching a new video series in May to coincide with Mental Health Awareness Week. Please check us out.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us again. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.